In my life, I've noticed that, and maybe you have too, that the medical profession does not exactly excel at endings. It's not their fault. I think it's part of our cultural desire to prolong life and to use everything at our disposal to save the patient. Hospice is not always welcomed so that one might die at home with dignity. Standard treatments move to new treatments, which give way to the latest treatments, which, once those things all fail, open the door for medical trials and the ultimate and sometimes ominous experimental treatment, which might happen here or in a foreign country. Most of us fight death until the end, which is, I think, as it should be, ultimately when the end comes, which it does for all of us. We don't really have the words to express it. I wonder if it is because we have spent the bulk of our words on controlling the now and securing our futures in the face of death walking right towards us, or even harder sometimes, death becoming our familiar companion. I'm not sure if my father actually died at home or in the hospital. The ambulance came and they worked on him, and then they took him to the hospital. That was his last day. After they were finished breaking the news to us, I had to leave the hospital. I had to walk out the door. I had nothing in my hands. No new treatment regimen that we were going to try. No meds. Nothing. I had to call my friend as I prepared this message for tonight because I couldn't remember. He was my friend who had taken my mom home. Did he remember how I got home? He didn't. My husband Mark thought that we went to our house to tell our kids, but we can't really remember. And so I realize I barely remember the hours after the doctor said he was gone, my dad. Just these feelings of nothingness. After the battle of a long illness and the war that is waged against death, death itself almost seems anticlimactic. I don't know what I expected, but it wasn't that. In a reflection piece written many years ago that I saved about Good Friday, a professor named Richard Lisher helped me to think about what I expected and what I did not experience in those hours. It's shaped much of what I want to share with you all tonight. Lisher expounded on the words of another great writer, a literary critic, actually, named Frank Kermode, and he wrote these words. He said that narrative plots and even life itself are like the tick and the talk of a clock. We construct this rhythm, tick-tock, because we need an identifiable beginning and a meaningful ending and something of significance in between. In fact, he asserted that only that talk makes sense of the interval between the beginning and the end. Christianity is preoccupied with the talk of Jesus' death. Recently, I read a book called The Girl on the Train. It was a novel by Paula Hawkins. There's a death in this book, but that takes up only a few pages. The rest of the pages of the book are full of the life of the girl on the train, right? I like to read murder mysteries, and the last one I read, Careless in Red by Elizabeth George, it's just over 700 pages. The victim's death is dispensed within just a few of those pages. 675 pages are about the lives of the community. In the New Testament, on the other hand, the events surrounding Jesus' death constitute between 50 and 60% of the narrative. At the end, we count out his words as if they're like valuable coins. The whole church leans in to hear the legacy that Jesus is going to leave us. And our questions about the end remind me of my own questions in the waiting room of the hospital with the ER doc. Are you sure? Was he conscious? Did he ever regain consciousness? Did he say anything? Did he suffer? Did he talk about me? The scriptural postmortem recorded in the Gospel of John is really clear. Jesus died more quickly than those who know about these things expected. During his 6 hours of dying, he showed kindness to those who attended to him. He expressed the full range of human anguish, from the absence of God to the absence of water. When he died, it was as if he was handing over his life to someone else, and at the end he said, "It is finished." In the English language, the word finished is what is known as a multiple meaning word. It can mean completed. Lori finished the floor upstairs in our building by bringing out its beauty. She stripped it and sanded it and finished it with stain and sealants. And now we can walk on it and occupy the space, and our artists can come in and begin creating in this new studio. The room will become something new for our community. When a builder finishes a house, there's something there to behold. There's a product, something to walk on, and something to live in. When a runner finishes a race, he or she has made it through to the very end. But there's another way to use this word, finished. Mostly we hear of it in England, and I read a lot of books written by British authors, so I hear it a lot. And it's the exact opposite. They use the word finished to mean something is all gone. Your waiter may say to you, "So sorry, the meat pie you ordered is finished." And the waiter doesn't mean there's a new pie hot out of the oven, ready to eat, coming to your plate. The waiter means it's all gone. Not completed, but depleted. When a person dies, I believe we want to know, is my loved one finished, like the meal that's been consumed, or is she finished like a runner who's completed and finished a race? And then we want to understand what the life and the death point to. We don't believe that Jesus died for the sake of dying. Billions of human beings have died since Jesus died. So why do we keep reciting the talk of his story? Ever since Jesus said it's finished, Christians seem to have placed our hope and our trust in the hidden possibility of completion over depletion. I don't believe we want him to have meant when he said, "It is finished," "Whew, done with this." Or maybe even worse, oh, this is it, crap, I'm a goner. I don't believe we want that. John's gospel has quite an authoritative end to Jesus' ministry and life, but I'm not sure we have hold of it anymore. The TikTok way of narrative doesn't really work for us here. Not today, in our day and age. Because I think we live more of a talk tick, caught between the many details of the death story of Jesus, and then we seek some greater meaning out of all of it so that we might understand the completeness of what his life meant and what it's supposed to mean today for us. After all, his suffering and death can't have been in vain. I want to know, but I don't really want to live in that question for very long, honestly. Because isn't the main goal of life to maximize the good? To figure out our harm and be corrective? To make better choices? To be happy? To plan for the future? Isn't that our main goal of living? In a column on suffering a few years back, New York Times writer David Brooks said this: "We live in a culture awash in talk about happiness. In 1 3-month period of 2013, he said, there were more than 1,000 books in a 3-month period newly released on Amazon on the subject of happiness. I've noticed that when people actually remember the past, they don't just remember the happiness. It is often the ordeals that actually end up being the most significant. Sure, we aim to be happy, but I'm afraid that it's actually our suffering that becomes formative for us. Sometimes suffering is just suffering, like failure is simply failure, but sometimes physical suffering, physical illness, or social suffering, like the breakup of a relationship, ends in the talk of a deeper awareness of others. And it may be counterintuitive, but personal suffering, after drawing us into ourselves, actually takes us outside of ourselves so that we become able to see the vulnerable suffering rendered in the lives of our neighbors, of our friends, and of our loved ones. When Christians talk about what the church has to offer the world, you know, one thing I don't hear many of us mention is, hey, we are great at suffering. Come on in. I know. Because like everyone else, we live in a culture that recognizes success and that never seems to tire of raising that success bar. Being a successful human being means making straight A's, getting and keeping a well-paying job that you like with solid benefits, if possible, staying happily married to an attractive person, raising well-adjusted children, never gaining too much weight because we are healthy and we exercise regularly. Mm-hmm. And if I'm really honest, being happy also means having a really good smartphone, having a young-looking appearance, and choosing the right medication to beat depression once and for all for good. Yep. This leaves a lot of room to fail. But the same culture that creates these conditions for failure doesn't really seem up to the task of dealing with it. For those whose life or death fits no orderly pattern, Jesus' triumphant cry offers completion in the midst of whatever messy business we find ourselves. We meditate upon his death and hang upon his last words because I think, despite our posturing and our protest to the contrary, there is nothing we want more than a life of meaning and wholeness. Did Papa mention me? The adult child asks, as if his sorry life might be sobered up and rehabbed by the word of a dead man. Did he say my name before he died? I know that not everyone experiences growth following suffering. But the story of Jesus' death may be corrective for us if we are willing to sit with the question for more than just a fleeting moment or a week here and there. It's not easy, because his dying on the cross has a ring of failure to it. We come to church to be reminded and to remember that there is no shame in failure as we sit together at the foot of this cross. And on Holy Friday, we remember the one who fought to love first. And when he was in the presence of the hungry, he fed them. And when he came upon fishermen who longed for a deeper calling than fishing day in and day out, he took them along with him and taught them. He healed the sick and blessed the poor and ate with outcasts, and he brought women from invisible status to disciple at work. His life ended in suffering, and since we too know that fate, when that happens, he becomes one of us. See, again and again, in death as in his life. And I don't know about you, but his suffering makes a road for me into myself and into life that is real. Failure and all. It means my brokenheartedness gets mysteriously somehow linked to all of yours and to God's, which somehow makes it a little less scary for me as long as we are sitting together here in this room and in this life. I don't believe that Jesus' death, his painful death on the cross, was anything but horrific. I really do think, though, that in that moment, everything was lost to him. And I think it was lost to those who loved him most. And I know what that feels like. The moment the talk sounds at the end of love, when I am my most abandoned and left and bereft, and the center is no longer holding together. So tonight I stand with him and with all of you as one posed and poised to suffer and to fail as spectacularly as I can in my own bid for true and lasting and real and meaningful love and life.
Oh God, have you forsaken me? Forsaken me? Forsaken me, oh God, have you forsaken me? Forsaken me. My God, have you forsaken me? Forsaken me. Forsaken me. My God, have you forsaken me? forsaken me, forsaken me.